Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For decades now, Americans have been used to going to the store, Walmart, Target, Gap, more, and getting quite a lot for a little. Yes, it was made abroad, but it sure felt good at the checkout counter. Now, America's biggest retailers and importers warn those days could soon be over. They forecast huge price increases in consumer goods under a tax reform plan by House Republicans. But American exporters are ecstatic about the plans. More American jobs, they say. The business community is deeply divided. The public is just tuning in. This hour in our On Point 100-Day Spotlight, the looming tax reform battle and what it could mean at the store, at the checkout counter, for your job. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you prepared to pay more for clothing, for electronics? Is it worth it if it brings manufacturing jobs back to the U.S.? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at Warren Buffett's latest investment moves. He's dumped 90% of his Walmart stock and put big money into airlines. But first, imports, exports, and tax reform. Joining me now from Washington is Barney Jobson, U.S. policy correspondent for the Financial Times. His piece, Trump and the Tax Plan Threatening to Split Corporate America, appeared in the FT on Monday. He's been following this tax proposal for several weeks and the response from business, Congress, and the international community. Barney Jobson, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
You say that this tax plan is putting a big divide, almost creating a civil war in the American corporate community. Why? What's going on, Barney?
So this is a radical proposal, one of the most radical proposals we've seen on tax reform in maybe 30 years. It's come from Republicans in the House of Representatives, and what they're trying to do is make America a more attractive place to invest. But the core of their proposal is that in order to do that, they want to start levying tax on any imported goods that come into the country, and they want to exempt from taxation any exports that go out of the country. That, in theory, would be great for encouraging domestic manufacturing, and we certainly know that Donald Trump wants to see a manufacturing renaissance. The problem is that a huge amount of what Americans consume right now is imported. It's imported by retailers like Walmart and Target and Best Buy, who then put the stuff on their shelves. And the retailers are saying that if you impose a tax on these imports, it would be a 20% tax. That's going to wreak havoc with our businesses. We're either going to have to cut jobs to save money, or we're going to have to hike the prices of those goods. Otherwise, our businesses just aren't going to work. So that's a really serious warning for consumers that they may potentially be asked to pay more money for their food, for their clothing, for their electronics if this proposal goes ahead.
Talk about the companies that would be hurt, the companies that would be helped, the kind of thing by brand name and the kind of things they do.
So the big retailers that you see in your local strip mall are all going to be affected by this. I mentioned Walmart, Best Buy, clothing retailers as well. The Gap would be affected. They're out there lobbying against this. Nike's also out there lobbying against this. So basically any retailer which sells imported products, which is most of them, would be effective. So we've seen a remarkable kind of reaction from the sector. You know, normally business groups don't like to stand up and make a big fuss about things, but they're really, really energized about this. And just yesterday, we saw a group of retail CEOs in the White House meeting President Trump to make their case. And that's a kind of an expression of just how much they feel is at stake here.
Who would be helped and how?
So the flip side is that this proposal, which, as I say, is designed to encourage American production, would be a big boost for companies which export. The big names there are Boeing exporting airplanes, GE, General Electric exporting all kind of energy-related products, Dow Chemical, Pfizer, the drug maker. Any big name like that which exports products would benefit massively because effectively they'd be able to sell their stuff in the rest of the world and they wouldn't be taxed on the income they gain from those foreign sales. So that would be a huge incentive to create more jobs here in the US. And of course, that's what Donald Trump wants. He wants to see a surge of job creation.
This is all linked to the president's push to cut the American business tax rate from 35%, where it is now, to 20%. What's the connection between that goal and this plan, Barney?
So this is a plan that was developed in Congress, and you know, in other circumstances, you might expect Congress to come up with a plan and the president from the same party to adopt it. But right now, President Trump has not taken a stand on this proposal precisely because it's so controversial. And this is really important because the president has campaigned on and told us since the election that he wants to make tax reform and a reduction in the tax rate a centerpiece of his efforts to create more jobs. But the fact that the only plan on the table is creating such controversy is a real problem for the White House. They're not sure whether they're going to embrace it or not. And if they choose not to, if they decide that, you know, they can't take the heat on this, it means we're back to square one on tax reform. We've got to go back to the drawing board. And if that happens, it's going to delay President Trump's ability to deliver on this campaign promise anytime soon.
At the heart of what's interesting here to retailers, and ultimately, if this goes through to consumers, is what's called a border adjustment tax. That's a funny, it just sounds like a tariff to me, but a border adjustment tax, what would that be on what?
So the border adjustment tax is the label for what we're talking about here. It means that when a product leaves or arrives in the US, the tax treatment kind of changes. So with let's take the example of Walmart. If Walmart's importing T-shirts from China, when those T-shirts arrive in the US, Walmart will effectively be asked to pay a tax on those T-shirts. At the moment, it doesn't have to pay a tax. Under this proposal, those T-shirts would be taxed when they arrive in the U.S.
At what rate?
It would be 20%. 20%. That's the kind of the key number here. On the flip side, there are a few T-shirt manufacturers in the U.S. Not a lot. The industry has rather died in the last few years. But if we take the example of a U.S. T-shirt manufacturer, maybe American Apparel, when their T-shirts are shipped out of this country to Canada, let's say, under this proposal, the money they earn on those T-shirts from selling them into Canada would not be taxed at all. So that would be free money, you know, free from the tax man's hands. So that's the big difference. Tax the imports, don't tax the exports. That's your border adjustment.
20% tax on every import to this country, and we know how much this country imports. That is a lot of revenue. What role does that huge chunk of revenue, or would it play, in offsetting the cut on corporate taxes from 35% to 20%?
Well, that's really the nub of the issue. That's the crucial thing here. This proposal is not just a nice sounding idea to people who want to see that manufacturing renaissance. It's also the way you pay for a cut in the overall tax rate. This proposal would yield, according to some estimates, about $1.1 trillion over 10 years. That's a huge amount of money. And that would enable the Republicans to cut the headline tax rate paid by companies from 35% at present down to that 20%. The problem is, if this proposal is so controversial that the president decides he can't take it, then the whole plan falls apart, because if you lose the $1.1 trillion, you don't have a means for funding the tax cuts. You've got to go back to the drawing board.
What would it mean for American consumers? I've been around long enough to remember when going shopping for clothes meant what felt like a significant financial expenditure. I mean, it's still not nothing, but if you go to many American retailers these days, you're going to have relatively inexpensive imported clothing from all over the world. Americans, and electronics very similarly, Americans have become accustomed, and yes, there's been a giant cost on manufacturing going abroad, but they've become accustomed to rather low cost profile for an awful lot of consumer items. What would it mean on that front, Barney?
Well, you're right. Over the last 20, 30, even 40 years, the consumer economy has been built around the imports of products from low cost locations, whether it's China, Vietnam, or Mexico. So this plan is precisely so radical because it would upturn that trend of outsourcing that we've seen for decades. And if it did result in much less importing of products and much more US production, US production would inevitably be more expensive. And that would push up the prices for consumers. I mean, one estimate we've heard from one group of retailers is that the import tax would result in families paying $1,700 more per year on food and gasoline and electronics. So that's a big change. But one of the question marks here is whether it's really realistic to imagine that you can have a renaissance in U.S. production of many of these goods. Can we really imagine that we're going to see a surge of American T-shirt factories popping up around the country? There are a lot of economists who say it's just not realistic. The U.S. doesn't have the right skills base. It doesn't have the low-cost labor that you need to do that.
Maybe it doesn't matter, Barney. Maybe we get a bunch of new Dow Chemical and Boeing and Caterpillar and Pfizer plants around the country with paying good wages, and people can just pay more for goods. They can just eat the difference.
I mean, that would work if the only people shopping were the people who were enjoying these new jobs in these new factories. But I think what would happen is that we'd see a much broader group of people affected by higher prices on the shelves and a smaller group of people benefiting from the job creation. So that's why some economists at least warn that this would be particularly hard on lower income Americans who probably wouldn't be getting the jobs in the Dow Chemical and the Pfizer factories, but would still be shopping at Walmart.
This plan comes out of the House Republican quarter, and yet you describe almost a civil war among American corporations over this right now. We know Congress is Congresspeople are very attentive to that. What does it mean for the odds of passage that there's so much tension within the business community over this?
So tax reform has always been really hard. Mm-hmm. And when you have a corporate civil war on your hands, when you have some of the biggest names in American business squaring off against each other, it makes lawmakers even more skittish. It makes them even more nervous about what they're proposing. And we're seeing that nervousness spread a little bit. And the House Republicans still like this plan, but in the Senate, which obviously also has a say, there are certainly some signs of wariness. Any lawmaker is going to be scared when somebody knocks on his door and says, hey, if you approve this proposal, you're going to have your constituents coming to you saying, why did you add X dollars to my tax bill? So we're certainly seeing some nervousness about this spread. But I think the key thing is, where does President Trump come down on it?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the tax reform battle looming right now, this time with big implications for what you spend at the store, maybe for your job. American business is excited and deeply divided over what may be coming. Exporters, thrilled. Retailers, freaked. Barney Jobson's been writing about it for the Financial Times, and he joins us today from Washington. You can join us as well. Are you ready for this? Can you live without the bargains in clothing and electronics we've all grown used to, without those great prices at Walmart, Best Buy, Target, Gap? Is it worth it for maybe more jobs at Boeing, Caterpillar, Dow, GE, Pfizer? How would you tell your congressman, woman, to go on this one? And how would it hit your business? David French joins us in a moment. He's lobbying for retailers out there, and they have been pretty freaked out by this House Republican plan. They sat down yesterday at the White House with President Trump, the heads of Target, JCPenney, Best Buy, and others. Little public comments from the president there. He sang the industry's praises.
You're some of the great CEOs of our country and the biggest in the retail industry, which is very important to the country. It's supporting millions and millions of jobs. Really one of the great job producers.
And yes, he talked about tax reform, said it's coming, going to be massive.
Tax reform is one of the best opportunities to really impact our economy. So we're doing a massive tax plan. It's coming along really well.
Will it have a lot to do with consumers? You bet it will. Consumption-based taxation. In a CNBC interview on Tuesday, House Ways and Means Committee member, California Republican Devin Nunes, was asked whether a border adjustment tax was the only way to pass tax reform. Here's what he said.
The only way that we can actually get our tax code into the 21st century and make America the most competitive place on the planet is to move to a full consumption-based system. Which would be, quite frankly, very simple to implement.
Consumption-based. If you're a consumer, pay attention to that piece. Barney Jobson, please stand by in Washington. Lots of callers, then we'll go in just a moment to David French. Tom in Burlington, Wisconsin. Tom, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
The smart money on Wall Street is in panic buying mode. The only way to fight against inflation is to buy stocks. The stock market is not going up because there have been any appreciable changes in profits. It's the leading indicator, and the smart money is buying to hedge against the inflation.
What does inflation fear have to do potentially with this tax plan, Tom?
It's going to destroy everything. Inflation just it's devastating for an economy.
But why would this tax plan, I guess you're saying this would lead to inflation? Why?
Well, it's all about getting the revenues. All right, if he wants to get the revenues, that's one thing. But on the other side of the balance sheet, he wants to do all this spending, and it's not going to work. It can't work.
It can't work. Ronnie Jobson, you're listening here. Inflation, is that somehow baked in this cake of tax reform necessarily?
Yeah, I think Tom's right. I think that if this tax proposal did go ahead and retailers were forced to push up their prices, then that's inflation for you. And that has knock-on effects on household spending. And you know, the Federal Reserve spends a lot of time trying to keep a lid on inflation. So that's certainly something to worry about. And just on Wall Street, we've seen a big rally in Wall Street driven by expectations that the president is going to push through tax reform. I think what Wall Street has yet to wake up to is the complexities of this proposal and the fact that the uproar it's triggered is really reducing the chances of tax reform. I think probably the stock market has got a little ahead of itself and needs to recognize that life is not so simple in Washington.
But a debate embedded in this. Randy in Burnside, Kentucky. Randy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, sir. I want to challenge this president to bring his suit and his dog line back to America and have American workers to put them together.
To bring his clothing manufacturing back here. But what about this tax plan, Randy? If it makes it harder for Walmart to, more expensive for them to sell, and a lot of others, to sell lots of goods from China and elsewhere, how do you feel about it?
Well, let's have him, he says, you know, America first, American jobs, let's have Americans put them together instead of foreigners, and then let the chips fall where they may.
Randy, I appreciate your call. Barney, what about it? I mean, is this likely to bring, I don't know, Donald Trump's ties and Ivanka's clothing line, their manufacturer, back to the USA? Randy says, do it.
Well, I think that would be a way to lead by example, wouldn't it? If the Trump businesses could show us that they can source products at an affordable cost in the U.S., then others would follow. But there are a lot of economists who are very skeptical about whether it's possible to make clothing in the U.S. at an economically sensible rate.
David in Moscow, Idaho. David, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to say that the ones that are getting forgotten are the small and medium-sized companies. They're the ones that can't survive this border adjustment tax. And the really painful piece of it to me is that destination-based was always a good idea, but not as a consumption tax. We should be going to a destination-based income tax, which means going after taxing profits, not the full sales margin that has been proposed in the border adjustment tax for importers.
Barney, help us here. What would the distinction be?
Well, I think one of the key distinctions that David's alluded to there is the difference between big companies and small companies. Now, there's an argument that whatever happens, you know, the giants of the world are going to be able to adjust to it because they've got the people, they've got the money.
Yep.
It's the small companies that may suffer. I spoke to a small Chicago toy maker earlier this week that gets 98% of its products made in China. And the boss of that company was saying, like, this would kill us. This would kill us. We're a small operation. We just don't have the slack to manage it.
Is he joking when he says kill us? Is that just hype because he doesn't like it? Or does he really mean put us out of business?
I think you do always need to take some of these warnings with a pinch of salt in these debates.
Yeah.
But if you look at his models, he says that his tax rate would kind of double, triple, and that's hard for anyone to cope with.
Let's go to David French. He's Senior Vice President for Government Relations at the National Retail Federation. Of course, retailers are all over this issue. He joins us from Washington. David French, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
How do you look at this House tax reform proposal, David?
Well, this is a proposal that has a few winners and a lot of losers. And I think consumers are going to be the biggest losers. Retailers have looked at the numbers here. All of our members have been working very hard since this proposal came out, trying to figure out how it would impact them. And they're predicting that it would cause their effective tax rate to go from 35% to 200 or 300% of their profits. Obviously, that's unsustainable. So they have to pass those costs on to consumers. This is a hidden tax on consumers. The reason Congressman Nunez calls this, you know, simple is because it's simpler than doing the hard work of income tax reform that might require duking it out with lobbyists in Washington. Instead, they want to pass the tax on, a hidden tax on to consumers, in a way that consumers are powerless to stop it. And that's why we're outraged. That's why we're engaged. We think we're the most effective voice for consumers in this debate. Let me also add, it's not just big retailers who are affected by this. There are millions of small retailers out there who will also be affected in exactly the same economic way.
But Donald Trump has said he wants to shift what's going on here in terms of the American economy and the rest of the world. Retailers, one imagines, have done quite well. Walmart built a giant empire over decades, and yes, they delivered low prices, but they also moved all their sourcing nearly overseas. I mean, maybe, you know, retailers have had some pretty good times on the back of low-cost overseas goods. Maybe it's time to bring that back, to see that swing, David.
Well, there's really no manufacturing capacity in the United States. Walmart built an empire based on delivering what consumers want in the way consumers want it. I think if you...
But it meant their jobs went away.
Well, it first of all...
We used to make socks in South Carolina.
We did, and I think recent studies have shown that 5 out of 6 of those lost jobs have not been because of trade, those lost jobs, but because of automation. And so we should be realistic about expectations about job creation as a result of any of these tax changes. By the way, there is a Made in America tax out there. I mean, the Made in America taxes are very high corporate tax rate. Mm-hmm. There's not some sort of extra tax on exports. That's a myth. But we have a corporate tax rate that's inefficient, and that's incented some companies to locate overseas. And those companies are some of the big manufacturers that want this plan to go into effect so that their corporate tax rate can go to zero.
But so, if you want to bring that tax rate down, the argument being made here is you have to pay for that somehow. This border adjustment tax, again, it looks like a tariff to me, but would raise, Barney says, a trillion plus, people are saying. How else are you going to pay for that corporate tax rate coming down?
All tax reform proposals are a series of choices. There are other choices that the tax writing committees can make. Devin Nunes articulated this. The easy choice to the Ways and Means Committee is to pass the bill on to consumers. They want large exporters to have a zero tax rate, and they want middle America to pay the bill. That's the easy choice.
Barney, that's pretty much what they are doing, right? I mean, they're pretty straightforward about that.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly one of the arguments out there. I mean, if I could ask David a question, David, you say that retailers have no choice or would have no choice but to pass this cost on to consumers. But they would have a choice because they could just accept lower profits for themselves, or they could try and cut their costs a bit. So why is giving the cost to consumers the only option?
Well, retail's been in transition for most of the past decade, and a lot of retailers have been under pressure since the Great Recession. Consumers, the full price consumer, is rarer than the Yeti. The full price consumer does not exist anymore. Discounters have survived because they've been the target for most consumers. Department stores who have tended to sell to more full price consumers than discounters. If you look at the performance of department store chains, it's been universally horrible over the past several years. This is a long term transformation in the retail industry. It has squeezed retail margins already to the breaking point. There's not a lot of extra room in retail margins to go down. The only choices are to close stores and shutter operations or to raise prices.
We've got questions for the two of you from Atlanta. John is calling. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just have a point about the tax.
Affecting the border adjustment tax.
Yeah, the exporters are gonna pay as well. I mean, you know, what's to prevent if we do a border export tax? What's to prevent, say, Mexico or the EU or Japan or China to slap taxes back on us?
Well, ours would be a border import tax. On the way out, they'd pay very little, but on the way in, yes. Barney, what about it? Are they doing it already abroad and we just don't, or would we get into a tit-for-tat situation here?
Well, there's an argument that this tax is already done in a different way overseas via a VAT, a value-added tax. But the bigger issue is that there is a high possibility of a tit-for-tat here, because a lot of other countries would dislike the penalty on the imports. They would see that as discrimination against imports, which is illegal under certain international rules. And at the Financial Times, we've already been told that in Europe, lawyers are looking at this and considering how they would mount a legal challenge against this case. So the possibility of a international legal battle over it is really there, and that's another reason to maybe have second thoughts about it.
You've got yes, David. Sorry.
Let me add that the scale of retaliation that's considered here would be massive. I think the largest case the U.S. ever lost was over a tax provision called ETI, and it was a $4 billion retaliation. The retaliation that I think we would encounter as a result of this has been projected to be as high as $365 billion. And that would be targeted against U.S. industries exporting abroad, and it would make those products uncompetitive. So it's a loser either way. Either consumers pay a lot more, or, you know, export industries are savaged by retaliation.
But you've got Republican congressmen saying, look, we have set up our system so that so much has gone abroad, and we want to turn that around. This was Illinois Republican Peter Roskam on Tuesday talking with Bloomberg. He chairs the House Ways and Means Tax Policy Subcommittee. He was defending the border adjustment tax. Look at other countries, he said.
160 countries around the world adjust their borders, adjust their taxes at the border, and what we're proposing is to do the same thing. And the currencies will adjust, and our argument and our appeal is to say, look, let's put American manufacturing on this sure footing, because we have created a system over a period of years that has pushed more and more business offshore. We've got to reset that clock and bring it home.
David French with the National Retail Federation says it would destroy American retailing and put a huge new, cost on American consumers. You hear Republicans right there saying, oh, we've got to turn this around. So much has flowed abroad already. David French, Barney Jobson, please stand by. Grover Norquist joins us right now from Washington, founder, president of Americans for Tax Reform, architect of the Taxpayer Protection Pledge, the one that they've got so many people over time, politicians to pledge that they would not raise taxes, would oppose any and all tax increases. He's played a big role for a long time in American tax policy. Grover Norquist, welcome to On Point.
Good to be with you.
What do you think of this tax plan that would have the border adjustment tax that would free up American exporters from a lot of taxation? What do you make of the shift in balance here, Grover?
Well, what you're looking at is a tax cut on a static level of about $2.5 trillion. So it's a tremendous reduction in the tax burden on the American people. It starts, as you pointed out, by taking the corporate rate from 35%, which makes us the highest in the world and a little bit stupid, down to 20%. But, of course, you have to add the state corporate taxes in, average that at 4 or 5. That puts it at roughly the European average, 23-24%. For OECD countries, and for pass-throughs, individual companies, small companies generally, that pay through the individual rate. The guy down the store is a business guy, but he pays individual taxes, not corporate taxes, comes down to 25% from about 40%. So it's a tremendous drop in the tax rate for business income. On the individual level, it takes the top rate to 33, the middle rates to 25, and then 12. For individuals, instead of 6 and 12 for the standard deduction, 6,000 for individual, 12 for families, it takes it up to 12 and 24.
But would this plan cream the consumer? Would it wipe out American retailing?
No, because you start with all of these various tax cuts that you're talking about. Your first $12,000 as an individual, 24 as a family, are not taxed at all. So it, on average, as you look at the growth from this, it increases, and this is a modest estimate, it'll increase about 10% people's incomes in the country on average. It's very, very pro-growth. I forgot to mention expensing for businesses. Instead of buying a building or a piece of machinery or a truck and expensing it over 3, 6, 20 years.
Do it all at once. Yes.
And that tremendously reduces the cost of investment. So the whole package is tremendously pro-growth and very good for both consumers and producers. Eventually, only people pay taxes. Companies don't pay taxes. Companies collect taxes from people. So this is a net tax cut overall on a static basis. Because it will create jobs, it is revenue neutral 10 years out. Not at first, but 10 years out.
David Prince, do you buy that math?
Grover said some other things in the past about how all border taxes are taxes on consumers.
All taxes are taxes on people.
We've run the numbers of what the House blueprint means, and our estimate is that the House blueprint is going to destroy 900,000 retail jobs in the first 5 years.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about the tax reform battle looming right now, this time with real implications for what you spend at the store, maybe for your job. American business is excited and deeply divided over what may be coming here. Exporters, thrilled. Retailers, you've heard it right here, freaked out. It will mean, if it goes through, higher prices. But there's all kinds of ways of being taxed. Its supporters say if we want to get the economy growing again, this is the way to do it. Others say, where does the weight of this fall? Barney Jobson is with us, U.S. policy correspondent for the Financial Times. He's been writing all about it. Grover Norquist is with us, been fighting on taxes for a long, long time with us today from Washington. David French is here from the National Retail Federation. Many of their members freak because you know what they sell. Listeners responding to this in a big way online here. Tyler says, Walmart and consumption is how we keep the poor distracted and docile. Tell a person who's making $8 an hour and works 25 to 33 hours a week with a family of four that a plain-colored T-shirt is now $24.99 and things will change. I guess not docile. Here's another listener who says, what about double-digit inflation? Not that it will be reflected in wage increases. But there are just simple questions here as well. Amanda asks, says, it's hard to find products where all the parts are made in the USA. Will the import tax apply to parts used to make stuff in the USA? Barney, what's the answer?
The answer is yes, but in effect, the status quo will not change for products that are made in the US and sold in the US. Nothing will change for them. At the moment, if you make something in the US and sell it in the US, it does get taxed to some extent, and that wouldn't change. The change is just for stuff that's coming in from outside or stuff that's made here and going elsewhere.
Okay.
Actually, Barney, that's not exactly true. This will be inflationary for even domestically produced goods. And this is a consumption tax, so the cost of the tax is going to be embedded in the cost of goods for domestically produced things as well as imported goods.
What about this question, Aki from David from Aki says, what will the future of online businesses, retailers like Amazon, look like with a new border tax? What about that, David? Same or different from standing physical retailers?
I think all retailers, whether it's Amazon or Walmart or a small Main Street retailer, are just about as concerned about this proposal. I think the economic impacts are roughly the same. But you raise an interesting point and something that I think people don't realize. A foreign retailer selling online and shipping into the United States direct to the consumer will not be subject to this tax. And so there is a big hole in this proposal that could not only be very damaging to retail, it could also ruin the revenue-raising prospects of this proposal as well.
A couple of questions from our listeners, and I'll bring them to you, Grover Norquist. Nancy in
sure.
Jonesboro, Tennessee. Nancy, you're on the air. Thank you. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I have a couple of comments or questions.
Yep.
First, I know that manufacturing facilities, they don't start up and running within 2 months, 5 months, 6 months.
Yep.
That they take a long time to get going, and it would actually be probably new companies that has to get up and running. So this isn't something that once you have this tax in place that they're automatically going to be new American jobs online. And then my other comment is that a lot of people are on fixed incomes, either on welfare or retired, whatever, that shop at Walmart, also at Dollar General stores, that it's even cheaper than Walmart.
Yep.
And they aren't going to benefit with a new job. They're going to be hurt drastically. And I think the fellow that was talking about the inflation part of it, it's going to be horrible for these people that aren't working together.
Yeah, Nancy, we've got it. Let us hold it right there. I'll get one more. I'll take them both to Grover Norquist, Sharon in Ravenna, Ohio. Sharon, you're on the air.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing to me because this doesn't seem to help Trump voters at all over what they call flyover America. I mean, those new factories, Boeing is going to bring, they're not going to put those in Steubenville, Ohio, or Circleville, or Mansfield. Those are going to be in other areas. So I don't see how that helps them. And the people that if they don't increase wages, those very people aren't going to be able to purchase as much. So if they don't purchase as much, the profits go down anyway. I don't see how this helps. I think it's a good idea to bring stuff back here. I wasn't a Trump voter. I don't think that's a bad idea. I think it's a bad way to do it if you don't increase wages so people can afford the stuff you're jacking the prices up on.
We've got it, Sharon, and I appreciate your call. Grover Norquist, Nancy, and Sharon there. You heard Nancy say, what about people on fixed incomes? They shop at Dollar General. They're not going to get higher wages. They don't have wages. How do they benefit? And what about Flyover America? Sharon's skeptical that they're going to get these great new factories if and when they come.
Sure. Two very good points. One of the key parts here, and we just mentioned it, is immediate expensing for business investment.
Yep.
So when you tell businesses you're not going to be paying a 35% tax on your profits, it's going to be 20%, people start to decide, I will do more of this, that, and the other thing. And you make immediate expenditures on new plant and equipment. And so while the plant and equipment isn't up and running this year, the people who build it are put to work immediately. When the Reagan tax cuts took effect immediately on January of 1983, you saw 4 million jobs created that year, 1 million in October alone. First year of the recovery under Obama was 1 million, a quarter of what the Reagan tax cuts gave you. So growth creates tremendous job creation, not down the road, but at the beginning, particularly as this tax cut is focused on getting people to create more jobs now and build factories for future production, both in services and in manufacturing. Certainly, Nancy's wisely chosen to live in Tennessee, one of the nine states with no income tax. Wise choice in that. And then the other questions about middle America, taxes, you know, Ohio and so on. I was just in North Dakota. They're looking forward to 60 days from now that the Dakota Access Pipeline was approved. Obama had this war on infrastructure and was stopping it. It's now been approved. 60 days from now, the oil flows. The state alone is going to gain in tax revenue $300 million a year. This is going to be a tremendous job and income creator for the people of North Dakota, which qualifies as, unfortunately, as flyover country, I guess, in some people's minds on the coast. If you look at where
that question came from, Ohio, Grover. The question came from, yeah, our caller was in Ohio.
Correct.
Just
in Ohio, Pennsylvania.
She was not on the coast. She was in Ohio, I'm just
yes,
saying.
Yes, 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 yes. No, I didn't mean to. I was not criticizing her.
Yeah.
I think she was quoting coastal people talking
about
the country.
I've got just a minute here. David French, if this goes through, do we have a different country, a different economy?
I think it was Nancy who said this is a very regressive tax, and it's going to be paid disproportionately by folks on fixed income and lower income people, and they're not going to share in the benefits of some of the other provisions of the tax break. Look, I agree with Grover that a pro-growth tax code is really a good thing, and we should be moving towards a pro-growth tax code. But this choice, shifting the cost of paying GE's taxes onto the backs of middle America, is not the only way to do it. And we should go back to the drawing board and find a better way to do it that is not so punitive to middle-income America, not so punitive to fixed-income consumers, and not so dangerous in terms of inflation and recession.
Barney Jobson, we've got the president tweeting just today. Stock market hits new high, longest winning streak in decades, great level of confidence and optimism even before tax plan rollout. What are the odds that these provisions are in the rollout? What are the odds that this ultimately goes through, Barney?
I think at the moment I would say it's 50-50, but this is one of these moments in American history when tax reform actually represents a pretty fundamental choice for the country. And I think it's, does the president want to focus on maintaining access to low-priced goods, or does he want to push ahead with trying to create more jobs? It's about kind of good jobs versus cheap products, and that's the choice that that he's got to make.
This is the real stuff. It's happening right now and in the weeks and months ahead. Barney Jobson at the Financial Times. Thank you very much for being with us today, Barney.
My pleasure.
Grover Norquist at Americans for Tax Reform joining us today from Washington. Thank you very much for being here.
Certainly. Good to be with you.
And David French at the National Retail Federation. Thank you for joining us, David.
Thanks, Tom.
In a moment, a look at Warren Buffett's latest investment moves. His company sold about 90% of its Walmart stock last quarter. This is On Point. Berkshire Hathaway's latest quarterly update with the Securities and Exchange Commission shows Warren Buffett's holding company sold off 90% of its Walmart stock and nearly quadrupled its stake in Apple. It also disclosed new investments in major airlines. Joining me now to look at what the Nebraska investment guru's moves could mean is Josh Funk, business reporter for the Associated Press, based in Buffett's hometown of Omaha. He covers Berkshire Hathaway and many industries where Buffett holds investments. Josh Funk, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. We've just been talking about potential changes in the tax code that it seems would hurt Walmart. What's Warren Buffett looking at in basically bailing out of Walmart stock?
Well, one of the things with this latest filing is that it doesn't tell us what Warren was thinking. They just list the companies that they held at the end of the year, and it kind of leads to some guesswork about what was behind the moves. We expect that later this month we'll get some more details when Warren releases his annual letter to shareholders. That comes out on Saturday the 25th, and so that's when he's likely to go into more detail about why he's investing in airlines now and what he was thinking about some of these other moves.
I'm sure that smart guys like you and others are thinking about this. It's almost $1 billion, $900 million worth of Walmart stock that Berkshire Hathaway sold off. What's the speculation about why they may have done that?
Walmart is one where he's been reducing the investment for a couple years now. Back in 2015, they held about 60 million shares of Walmart stock. And then going into this quarter, they had about 13 million. And then, as you say, they cut it down to about 1.4 million shares. And it was a big reduction going from about $1 billion down to about 100 million or so at this point. But it's one that's been reducing over time. Warren, in the past, has said that he still likes Walmart and is sort of a fan of their company. But basically, he's found someplace else that he thinks that his money can do better for Berkshire Hathaway shareholders.
Could this mean that Walmart's great day in the sun, the long decades when it just grew like Topsy off of this sort of triage of the labor cost differential between China and elsewhere and the United States, offer this huge opening, this huge opportunity? Is the sun set on that?
I think it's hard to say if the sun is set on it, but certainly Walmart in the retail world is in an extremely tough business with competition increasingly from Amazon and online, as well as Target and other retail players. I know in the past Buffett has said that retail is an extremely tough business to compete in because you have to continually be right every day, and make the right decision over and over again in order to keep your advantage.
Buffett has quadrupled Berkshire Hathaway's stake in Apple. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's one that they first disclosed an Apple investment last spring, and then this was a significant increase in it, going up to almost 60 million shares of Apple stock. That's one that we're still kind of looking for some more explanation from Warren on, because for years he talked about not being willing to invest in technology companies because he felt like he couldn't really predict the future of them that well. He says that for years they fell outside of his circle of competence, is how he talks about his investments. He tries to stay into industries and companies that he knows and avoid ones he doesn't know. And so, obviously, an investment in Apple is one that we're still looking for a little bit more explanation on.
They've got now a $7.7 billion investment in Apple, up a couple billion dollars just in the last quarter. Of course, Apple is pretty reliant. Yeah, great brand and great products, but pretty reliant on imports from abroad. Does Warren Buffett follow the kind of tax reform talk that we've just been in the middle of for this hour? I know he's got usually a long time horizon on his investments.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly would be following the talk, but when he's making his investment decisions, he's making bets on things and competitive advantages that are going to last for years or even decades. He likes to say that when you're investing, you should be picking a company that you'd be comfortable holding 5 years or 10 years down the road if the stock market closed and you couldn't sell it. So
be happy to have it, and be happy to have it for a long time. And then we come to airlines. Now, this has been a famously volatile industry for a long time, sharp ups and downs even within a given decade, I guess. What's the speculation about why Buffett may have gone so big on airlines, and where has the money gone there?
Yeah, and with airlines, it's such a shift, too, because in the past he's been a real sharp critic of airlines as an investment. He was joking in his annual letter to shareholders just a couple years ago about a smart investor would have done good by shooting down the Wright brothers in order to save a lot of headache and lost
yeah,
money.
Right.
Over the years, and now clearly he's changed the way he thinks about airlines. The speculation there is that just through the bankruptcies and mergers we've seen in the industry, that the airlines have become a lot more competitive and more solid companies than they used to be, with the better ability to set their own price and maintain a profitable margin. The airlines, he kind of invested across the board in the big players. He's got big stakes in American Airlines, Delta, United, Continental, and Southwest, and all of those were increased in the last quarter. It's about $9.3 billion worth of investment across the board in all of those, and each one of them is about a little over $2 billion in an investment.
So for consumers or travelers listening, I guess implicit in that is that they'll have some pretty significant price-setting power for some considerable time to keep up the profits that they've gained in recent years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Buffett really seems to be making a bet on the industry as a whole rather than any single player. You know, he's got investments in those four big airlines.
Well, we'll see what happens. If globalization is over, it may have to be a lot of domestic travel, Josh.
Yep.
Warren Buffett. So when does he come out with his explanations for all this?
His annual letter to shareholders comes out on Saturday the 25th. They'll post that online at berkshirehathaway.com, and that's always a well-read business letter, just because his talent for taking really complicated things and explaining them simply, and he also usually works in a good joke or two.
Very big
letter.
Yep, very big moves by the Oracle of Omaha, Warren Buffett, and his holding company Berkshire Hathaway. Josh Funk covers it for the Associated Press. Joins us today from Omaha. Josh, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure thing. Glad to be here.
90% of Walmart stock out of that portfolio. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Be the first to find out tomorrow's topics and guests by going to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit the like button there and you'll get alerts on upcoming shows right there in your news feed. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.